today, I continue the discussion of the quantization of gauge theory by discussing more of this mysterious or a bit strange Fadeyev-Popov determinant and how one deals with this term in perturbation theory. And after that, I will make a short discussion about the properties under renormalization of gauge theories. It will be very sketchy because the calculation are longer. À quelle heure? Parce que je dois déjeuner avec avec Jamie.
Ouais.
Mais vers, on a 10 000 et demi une heure. On peut se voir après, heures. Si vous voulez.
Moi, je vois votre.
OK, so gauge fixing. And the Fadeyev-Popov determinant. Okay, so just a short reminder. We consider, in our case, an SU2 gauge theory. I'm going to consider just the pure gauge at that stage because the coupling to matter is, in fact, not different from what it is for Abelian gauge theories. So I have a gauge field. A, which is in fact a collection of A mu A's of X, where the mu are Lorentz indices and the A are gauge indices. So the A goes from 1 to 3. That in fact A is a, so, but better to write A mu as A mu A TA, where the TAs are the, generators. Okay. And if you really like differential geometry, A is a connection, so it's a one form with value in a bundle of space time. So it's, okay. And gauge transformation infinitesimal. Infinitesimal gauge transformation are of the form A mu goes to A mu plus D mu of alpha. This is generalization of gauge transformation in where alpha belongs to the also to the adjoint representation, so it's an infinitesimal gauge transformation. So both this and this are 2 by 2 Hermitian traceless matrices for SU2. Okay, the T, since the TAs for SU2 are 1/2 of the sigma A Pauli matrices for SU2. Okay. And we have seen that the action is the Young-Mills action is 1/2 to a factor of -1/2 t squared, integral d4x, trace of f mu nu, with f mu nu, the stress tensor is just I times the commutator of a and dA, or let me just be sure of the sign. This is just this is d mu a nu minus d nu a mu, that's the original term, minus, that's minus the commutator of AMU and AMU. Remember, these are matrices, so they don't necessarily commute. Okay, so that's a new term associated to the fact that the group is non-abelian. Okay, so now we have seen that if we want to perform quantization, namely if we want to bypass integral or functional integrals, we must introduce the gauge fixing condition. For the same reason that we want to do, we have to do that, this in quantum electrodynamics, that's because the gauge symmetry, the local gauge symmetries, means that there is a redundancy in the description of the physical degrees of freedom, of the physics of the system, by the gauge potential, the gauge field. So I said that in general, this gauge fixing means that you have some function of A which is set to zero. So in fact, that's a set of gauge fixing condition on the gauge field at each point. So that's a very compact form to write this. And in our case, I was considering the Lorentz Landau Feynman gauge, which is that's the so AMU as indices, which is that d mu a mu minus some epsilon mu equals zero. So this is the ordinary derivative. And this is some function. So we have a family of gauge fixing conditions. Okay? And we have seen that this corresponds when introducing this gauge fixing condition in the space of all gauge, to choose the gauge slice and to integrate over this gauge slice. But in order to do, when doing this, we have to take into account which is a correct measure that ensures that we are not treating badly the gauge symmetry. And the measure when we restrict the integration over this to the integration of the gauge slice is going is given by a determinant. Yes?
When I'm told that we use something which has redundancy, so how does that happen that we didn't try or we did not find a formulation for the gauge fields with no redundancy?
Oh.
Like, we take too much component because it's convenient?
Yes. Okay. Well, I don't think it's astonishing, because the point is that it's a natural way to do this. So first it works, so it's just empirical, it's practical. But there are deeper, I think there are deeper reasons. I'm not familiar with this, but if you try to formulate gauge theories in a very geometrical way, in the theory of fiber bundle over some space, etc., in fact, it's also a natural setting. The gauge fixing, the gauge field corresponds to a connection, and the geometry of the object on which this quantum theory is based precisely on those connections. And the choice of a connection, you know, in differential geometry, value, you choose a coordinate system. And then you have to be sure that what you are studying is independent of your specific choice of coordinate system. So here it's the same. You have different connections that are going to describe the same geometrical object, but better to treat the theory of the geometrical object in terms of this general theory of all the connections that describes it, in the same way that when you start to study differential geometry, you start to think in terms of the description in terms of all coordinate system, and you check at the end that your results do not depend on the coordinate system or the patch of coordinate system you have taken. So I think mathematically, that's not surprising either. But It's a natural mathematical toolbox to study the geometrical object associated to the quantum theory of gauge field. Okay. I don't know if it's a satisfactory answer, but that's apparently people have been. Okay, so now what we have seen is that with this, the path integral, if you want, description, the following. We integrate over all gauge fields with the exponential of minus or I if we are in the Young mid section. We are in Minkowski space in this case. But then we have to introduce first our gauge fixing condition, namely something that I write very schematically, a Dirac delta function that ensures that f of a is equal to zero. So it's a Dirac delta function, if you want. So that's gauge fixing. This is a gauge fixing term. But then the correct measure is the absolute value of a determinant of a Jacobian, because we make a chain of variables, so there is some volume form. And this is basically the derivative. So this object is a matrix, so it's a differential. So it's a derivative of f of the gauge fixing condition with respect to infinitesimal variation of the f prime, in some sense, equals the of FA and the changes A into A plus D mu mu alpha. So this is, if you prefer, delta of F A mu plus D mu alpha under a variation of alpha. Okay. So I wrote yesterday the explicit form of this in the case of the Lorentz-Landau-Feynman gauge. But in fact, this explicit form with all the indices for the, let's say, the Landau gauge. But this very schematic way to write it means that since for f of a is just d mu a mu minus something that doesn't depend on a, you just have to replace a by a plus d mu of a in this constraint and make a functional derivative with respect to alpha. So in fact, you have one term which is the ordinary derivative times the covariant derivative applied to alpha. So when you take the derivative with respect to alpha in a schematic way, what you get is that f prime is just a differential operator, which is ordinary derivative with the upper indices, apply to the covariant derivative. Where, remember, the covariant derivative here is the covariant derivative applied on objects that lives in the adjoint representation with d mu. the covariant derivative acting on the adjoint representation fields or functions, because both A and mu lives in the space of belongs to the adjoint representation of the group. Okay? Therefore, this means that in fact, if you want, F prime of some object living in the adjoint representation is just d mu times d mu and the adjoint represent and the action of the covariant derivative in the adjoint representation. We've wrote it. This is just the ordinary derivative minus I times the commutator of the gauge potential with the function. So this is the differential operator whose determinant has to be taken into account in the path integral. So it contains two terms. It contains a term which is the square of the ordinary derivative, so that the standard Laplacian that we have been studied. And then there is another term, which is the ordinary derivative applied to the commutator of the object, the function to which we apply this operator, with a mu. So it will contain both derivative of the object and the object times derivative of a mu. So this is the most compact way to write this Fadeyev Popov determinant in the Landau gauge. Okay? Okay, so that's what we did yesterday. And we need, in fact, two important remarks. All this is okay, provided that the gauge fixing condition has only one solution, so picks up only one point. So if you have in your space of configuration a gauge fixing condition, which does, for instance, that's very schematic, this, you may have different equivalent gauge potential, which describes the same physical configuration. And by this functional integral, all of them are picked with a sign one. So that's not what we want to do. So in this case, it's a problem of the called Gribov copies. We have different copies of the gauge field that correspond to the same physical configuration. One has to be more careful. And not only one has to be more careful, but in fact, this is a problem that occurs in non-abelian gauge theories. So, as Val, what I'm going to do is that we can close our eyes when doing perturbation theory for the simple reason that if we have here the perturbative vacuum, which is A mu equals zero, which is a classical vacuum, the theory. And if we are doing perturbation theory, it means that we are exploring, you know, considering what is the effect of the fluctuation in the vicinity of this space. We make small variation of AMU and we fix a gauge condition in this neighborhood. Then there are no Grybov copy. Grybov copy occurs for sufficiently large deformation of the gauge field in general. And the fact that you can see that there is a problem is that, for instance, if you go and at some point you reach a point where you know there is some kind of bifurcation and Grybov copy occurs, in fact, the determinant vanishes and changes of sign. So that's one way to see the problem. Okay. Okay. So now, of course, all calculation can be done using this determinant and making perturbative calculation in A. But there is a beautiful trick that has been first proposed by Fadeyev and Popov. Two Russian, at that time, mathematical physicists. And Fadeyev, in fact, Ludwig Fadeyev, died quite recently. He had very well known for many, many other things, in particular his contribution to integrable systems. And so okay, which is a way to represent in a nice way this determinant. So now you have to remember two things. First, we have been studying such similar determinant when studying the effective action for the I-4 theory. Remember. So this is an object you shouldn't be afraid to. But now we have done something else. We have seen that if you use the Bayesian calculus, Gaussian, so using Grassmann anti-commuting variable, Gaussian integrals if determinants instead of 1 over square root of determinants or the usual Gaussian integrals. So this formal determinant, if we assume you are close to perturbation theory, so we assume that the determinant doesn't change sign, so we can replace the absolute value of the determinant by the determinant itself. Okay, we can write the determinant of this f prime. And in my lecture notes, I'm denoting it g because that's it's a Jacobian. But let me denote it f prime. We can write it formally as an integral over anti-commuting fields. These are going to be Grassmann anti-commuting fields times a Gaussian integral. And I'm going to write it. And since it's just a normalization, I am writing in Minkowski with an I here. Let me introduce an I, and I writing C bar, this is the conjugate of the field, times F prime times C. Okay, so that's general formula. Of course, this is so compact that this is black magic. So what does it mean? Remember, f prime is a differential operator that acts on fields that lives in the adjoint representation. So fields which are three independent components, like AMU, which has AMUA, and the alpha, which has alpha A components. So this means that, in fact, those fields, C and C bar, there must be three different fields. So I can write C So C is a function of x, and I can write as CA of x times TA, where TA are the generators of the SU2, the polymatrices. Okay? And similarly, C bar of x is a field that I'm going to write C bar, and I put the index here, A of x, where the index is downstairs. I don't know why. Okay. Okay. So in fact, I have three. So A goes from 1 to 3. So yeah, C bar is a compact notation for having three Grassmannian fields. Okay. Okay. And so this term, C bar F prime C, what does mean? C bar times F prime times C. This simply means, this is a very short notation, for the scalar product of C bar by F prime applied to C, where these are fields, so this is an integral over spacetime, Minkowski spacetime in this case, of C bar of x times this differential operator, E mu, ordinary derivative, covariant derivative, applied to C of x. So that starts to be a bit clearer, but remember, now if we want to take the indices, this is all the indices, before x, this is C bar A of x, E mu, times the differential operator here, which is D mu, minus the commutator of A mu with C. Okay, which means I, so d mu c A of x minus I times the commutator of A mu of x with C of x, and I take the component A. Okay. And this is these are matrices. So if you work out this, this is integral over M d4x CA of x. Well, here you can write, so let me, you can write this as, so this is d mu of CA of x, minus I d mu, I'm sorry, yeah, minus I d mu with respect to x of the commutator, and the commutator is, if you write it in terms of generators, this is going to be epsilon A B C, A mu B of x times C of x. Sorry, this is a gold field C, and the C is an index. So this is a field, this is an index. And these are just this is just the structure constant of SU2. Okay. It comes simply because for SU2, the commutator of TA and TB, which are matrices, is epsilon ABC TC. And if you like, you can get epsilon ABC out of the ABC, and then I get d mu of this object. Okay, so this is what this this is what this means. And DC bar and DC is going to be, as we did before, the measure is just the ordinary measure of over anti-commuting field. It has the same form as what we did for Dirac fields. So if we want to be, so this is, this is the action. This is the action. The measure is just, at that sense, this is formal. The measure of a DC bar C is just products of all points in space-time, products from A equal 1 to 3, and this is of DC bar A of X times DC of X, where this is a standard integration of a Grassmann variable. In fact, it is this integral which is defined as this product. Okay. Okay. And now the idea is that you can now. This term is rewritten as an exponential of something that we can put back in the action. What remains is just this delta function. So this delta function is something we can keep in the functional integral, but we can also represent the gauge constraint. That's the last trick. Not going to play an important role in the following, but let's state it. We can use the gauge constraint, gauge fixing constraint. The gauge fixing constraint, similarly, can be rewritten as the exponential of something just by introducing what's called an auxiliary field by writing the delta function as a Fourier transform. So that's something that I've not been doing here, but I think I use this just a bit later. Well, no, I'm not doing that, but you can do it. It's not in my note, but you can write delta of f of a. Remember, in fact, this is a product of this, the products over all points of space-time, and the products over all A of these constraints, because there is a constraint per gauge field. So we can rewrite this as, in fact, an integral over some, let's call it lambda field of exponential of I times B times F of A, which in our case is f of a, where in our case, I'm sorry, lambda case, where what does this mean? I have a field lambda A of x of a collection of fields, lambda f of a means in our case just integral over d4x of lambda a of x times d mu a mu a of x minus epsilon a of x. Okay? And integral over d lambda means simply products over x, products over a, integral from minus infinity to plus infinity of d lambda a of x. So that for each d lambda a of x, when you integrate lambda a of x times this, you get a delta function. Okay. So this is introduced by what is called an auxiliary field. Lambda a. Lambda, you see? It's a standard trick. Okay. So then what we get at the end of this. Oh, no, it's not working. It's just a functional integral where we integrate not only over A. Now we end up with a functional integral where we have an integral over all gauge fields. We have an integral over those auxiliary Padeyev Popov fields, which are Grassmannian. We have an integral over this auxiliary field, which is just there to represent as a Fourier transform the gauge constraint. And now we have an action which is of the form first the Young-Mill action for the gauge field, the original gauge invariant action. Second, let's write it as an integral. The C bar F prime of A C term, which is going to reconstruct the Fadier of the gauge fixing determinant, plus the lambda times F of A constraint. Okay. And again, each term is an integral of a space of something that contains the fields, products, local fields, and potentially the derivative. So this is what this means. So this is the lambda f of a term. Okay. So we have an integral of a gauge potential. We have an integral over those anti-commuting fields. And we have an integral, which is quite simple, over this auxiliary field, which just is there to represent the constraint. Okay. So now, all of those fields lives in the adjoint representation. So this transform in the same way under symmetric group. This is a bosonic field. This is a vector field. So spin one, and it's bosonic because it's commuting, so it's a boson. It's vector boson. This is, well, this field doesn't propagate, but it's a real field. So in some sense, it's a scalar spin zero boson, but it doesn't propagate. It's just there to implement a constraint, so it doesn't go. And this scalar spin zero, but they are fermions because they are anti-commuting Grassmann fields, so they should anti-commute. Okay, so those ones should violate. We have a problem with spin statistic. The spin statistic theorem states that for a unitary quantum field theory which satisfies, which is Lorentz invariant, fields with integer spin would commute, and fields with half integer spin should anti-commute. And those ones have integer zero spin, but they anti-commute. Yes? Because they carry no Lorentz index and they carry no Dirac index. They just carry a group index, so they transform in a non-trivial way under the symmetry group of the gauge symmetry group, but they cannot transform into something different under a Lorentz transformation. If you perform a Lorentz transformation on X, just transform according to the fact that the point change. No space-time. Lorentz or Dirac index. They do not belong to a non-trivial representation of the Lorentz group. So they are spin zero.
Trivial representation of Lorentz.
Okay, so that's the reason, that's why they are called ghosts. Well, that's denomination. So in fact, the field C is called the ghost field, the ghost field, and C bar of X is called the anti-ghost field. Because, well, from their coupling, you can see that if the C has some charge under the symmetry group, C bar has the opposite charge. Because they always appear as C, C bar. Okay. So C is denoted the ghost field, and C bar the anti-ghost field. Okay, but we are going to see that this is not a problem. In particular, this is the solution. This feature, the ghost field, is the solution to the problem of gauge, of how to quantize in a consistent way the gauge theory. Okay. So, now, let's, with this, so we have this Hamiltonian, where now we have an action which is a gauge fixed action. So this is a gauge fixed action. So we have introduced the gauge fixing condition, here Lorentz or Landau. We have introduced additional fields to take into account in proper way how we gauge fix, and we end up with an integral we still integrate over all gauge configuration, we integrate over those additional fields. But so in this picture, we have an integrate over, we have still the space of all gauge configuration. We have additional fields, but when we integrate over this one, lambda, top, the integral is concentrated here for A. When you integrate over the C at the C bar, top, we get the correct measure. And then we can integrate over A, and we get what we are expecting to be the correct solution. Okay, so that's the idea. So those auxiliary fields are there in order to get at the end physical result. Okay. So now let me just summarize why with this procedure we get consistent Feynman rules for perturbation theory. Okay. So first, let's consider the Feynman rules for the gauge field. So remember, when we wrote the Young-Mills term, I already discussed this yesterday. Or back on Tuesday, I think. The Young-Mills action contains the term quadratic, which is exactly the same than the electromagnetism, plus some interaction term that comes from the fact that the A mu contains the F mu nu contains terms which are non-linear in the field because they involve the commutator of the field. The square of this term is going to be exactly the same one than the one in Maxwell's theory. So okay. So we use the gauge fixing. The gauge fixing get rid of the problem of the propagator. And you can check that with this choice of gauge, the Landau gauge. If you compute the propagator, namely A mu, A nu, A mu A of X, A nu B of X, which I'm going to call the G A B mu nu of X minus Y. This is going to be in the free, in the limit G goes to zero limit, so for the free theory. Okay. So we neglect the anti-commuting term. Then we get just, well, by Fourier transform, we just get the standard propagator for the photon in, well, this is going to be a capital K in four dimensions. We just get the standard propagator for the photon in quantum electrodynamics, which is minus I over K squared my I epsilon plus times H mu nu minus k mu divided by k squared, where h mu nu is the Lorentz tensor, metric tensor. Okay. And there is simply a delta AB in front, which tells us that the charge is conserved. You have n charge. This is as for the U1. Okay. So I'm going to represent this by the usual propagator of a photon. Simply now it carries Lorentz indices, because those are vector particles, and in addition it carries color indices. And the Lorentz indices mixes, because it's a vector particle, so the polarization changes, but the charge is conserved. The charge is conserved. Okay. And you can check that with this propagator, the longitudinal polarization do not propagate. We have only two polarizations. Two transverse polarizations. And that's simply because if you look for a gauge field which has a transverse, a longitudinal polarization which is in the same direction than the vector in which the gauge particle propagates. So we consider k mu times g mu nu of k. This is automatically zero, simply because here you have k nu, and then you have minus k squared divided by k squared times k mu. Okay. Okay. So this is exactly the same. Another side remarks that you find often, if you modified a bit the gauge condition, so it's a trick due to Feynman, if you change how you integrate over lambda, well, no, not exactly that, but you can change the d lambda. So delta over f of a by a term which is exponential of I times integral over d4x of d mu a mu of x. This is a Landau gauge squared with a factor, I think, 1/2. Some number psi, then we smear out the delta function, then the propagator becomes, well, you have the ordinal term, you have h mu nu minus, I think it's plus zeta minus 1 k mu k nu divided by k squared. Which is slightly different, but I'm not going to consider this because then it's a bit strange. Okay. In that case, this occurs only on mass shell. So that's slightly different. But then you need to use the fact that k squared is equal to zero. But okay, that's not a, so that's a, the case I'm treating in my notes, but we are going to skip with this. Okay. Okay, so now let's go back to the So this is a propagator. Landau gauge, gauge field, A propagator. Now, in the action, there is this term that contains a C bar d mu d mu CA. So it means that the ghost field, the ghost propagator, is non-trivial. See, the ghost field propagates. Yes?
Can you explain again this g goes to zero limit?
Pardon?
This limit g goes to zero? The propagator?
It's what do you ask me what does it mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. I explain a bit. Let's explain it just in the just for the I have to look for okay. Let me just take it. Remember, the Young-Mills action takes Young-Mills action is basically proportional to d mu a nu minus d nu a mu plus or minus I a mu a nu squared. You get the trace and you have a 1 over g squared. So you may ask, what's happening if g is very small? If g is very small, goes to zero, something will happen because this is an action which is not quadratic. So you can rescale, you can rewrite a into ga. Okay, so I just redefined the gauge field so that the original A is now GA. So then the Young-Mills action becomes integral trace of d mu A nu minus d nu A mu. But then there is a minus IG A mu A nu squared. Okay? So you see that this term is small. So this means that and G corresponds to the charge of the gauge field. So it means that in a regime where you assume that the charge is small, then this can be neglected. Okay? And then you end up with this quadratic term. One remark, if you do this, the definition of gauge transformation changes. Because the gauge transformation involves the gauge field. Yes?
Can you clarify what you mean by Ulmer Shawoni?
Pardon?
Can you clarify what you mean on that propagator, on mass shell only?
That's because I think that if I write k mu times this, if you have a psi term, then you have a term which you don't have a cancellation. So you have to work a bit more. You need to have k squared equals zero in addition. But okay, let me not elaborate. Okay. Details are in the note, and you find calculation using this in Peskin's book, for instance. So that's okay. Okay, so let's go back to the ghost propagator. Is this clear? If you, the ghost propagator, so the ghost propagator is just given by this term, which is just the Laplacian as for the scalar field. So the ghost propagator is the same as the massless scalar field. Okay? And so if you compute in this approximation CA of X times C bar B of Y. Let's call this C A B bar of X minus Y. B bar because B is affected to C bar. By Fourier transform, you get that C A B bar of K is just delta AB, as usual, times minus I over K squared minus I epsilon plus. So this is just the standard propagator of a massless scalar field that we can represent by this line. So I can represent, okay, so let me represent that standard, the ghost, by a dashed line, because they are ghosts, so they are not real enough to be represented. So this is, they are fermions. So they still have C's and C bars, so they carry charges. And this goes from A to B. Okay, so this is my representation for the gauge field. This is my representation for the gauge field. And now, now you have the interaction vertices. Okay. I already discussed the interaction vertices coming from the terms in the Young-Mill action. So I wrote them explicitly, so I won't have time, and anyway, I won't need the exact form. But basically, you have interaction vertex for the gauge field. So gauge fields, you have this times this, which gives 3. Gauge field vertex. Okay. And this interaction vertex mixes the quantum numbers, because there is an epsilon ABC, so this is proportional to ABC. You see? And with this approximation, it's proportional to G. So it's proportional to G, and it's also proportional to the momenta. Because here you have a momenta, here you have a momenta, here you have a momenta, and since the 3A terms contains a d mu, this gives a k. So it has a dimension of a momenta. It carries indices. It's written explicitly in my notes, it's written in the Peskin books, it's written everywhere. So in dimension of momenta, it has dimension 1. It contains some k mu. It's okay. Now we have a 4 interaction gauge interaction vertex. D. Okay, which is proportional to G squared. Well, there is a complicated structure in terms of the indices of the gauge field and of the Lorentz indices of the gauge field. The gauge field carries also some Lorentz indices, so they carry some group indices. Oh, here this is A mu, B mu, C rho, and D, let's say, sigma. Okay. So G squared, but that's, they carry no dependence on the momenta, but there are a lot of tensors. Times tensors in the group indices and in the Lorentz indices. Okay. But now we have something else. We have this term, C bar D mu A mu C, which means that there is an interaction between the ghost fields and the gauge field, which comes from the fact simply that this operator is Jacobian, depends on A, because it's there to absorb the D dependence on the measure that was represented here. So it's expected. So we have, in addition, a ghost interaction vertex. Okay. Which involves an incoming C, an A, and an outgoing C bar. Okay. And now remember the gauge field carries group indices and Lorentz indices. The C field here carries only a C index, and the C bar field here carries only a A index. Okay. And if the A field carries the C bar, the outgoing momentum is, if there is an outgoing momentum K here, here there is an outgoing momentum, Q. Here there is an incoming momentum P, let's say. And of course, we have that P plus Q equal K by conservation of momenta. And since there is a d mu of a mu plus c, there is a contribution proportional to the sum of the incoming momenta, namely proportional to the sum to the outgoing momenta. So the contribution of this vertex, there is a factor g, because when we make this rescaling, then one a, there is a p mu, there is a p mu, so there is one derivative, it depends on p, and the p and the gauge field carries a Lorentz index, it's a vector particle, so it's p mu, and then you have a tensor, and the tensor in that case is, if I'm not mistaken, minus epsilon a b c. As expected, you could expect, it's proportional to the structure constant of the group, which contains the information about the non-commutativity of the group. Okay, so still you have a power of g, you have a momentum, and you have a tensor, which in that case is just a group tensor. Okay. Okay, and that's it. So now, those are the Feynman rules of the pure gauge theory. And if you add matter fields, if you have, for instance, Dirac fermions, that's what we do in QCD, for instance, where in QCD you have the quarks, which are Dirac fermions. Then the Dirac fermions belongs to the fundamental representation of the group. So you have psi bar and psi phi phi that carry Dirac indices, and that carry I equal 1 to 2 group indices in the fundamental representation. Okay. And then the Dirac fermions, I'm going to represent the propagator, but the usual line with an arrow as in QED. Okay, so this is going to be the standard Dirac propagator. And the charge is going to be unchanged. And in addition, you have an interaction between the photon. The photon carries a Dirac index, Lorentz index, and a group index that belongs to the adjoint representation. The fermions carry Dirac indices, okay. And what you find as an interaction vertex is just the ordinary electron photon interaction, okay, times a group coefficient, and this group coefficient is just going to be the standard one. So it's going to be the IG matrix element of the generator TA. Those are the... Yes?
Sorry, what are the alpha and beta indices?
Alpha and beta are just the Dirac indices, the four Dirac indices. Remember, a gamma matrix G mu is a matrix G mu alpha beta. Alpha beta goes from 1 to 4, which is in fact 2 to the power of, which is the dimension of the representation. The standard Dirac indices. Okay. Okay. And so this is it. And so now these are the Feynman rules that can be used to compute a process in gauge series, first at tree level, and then at generation level. So I have only 20 minutes left. So first, I'm just going to state that the fact that those ghost fields are there do not make the theory non-unitary. That's the contrary, in fact. They are there to implement the unitarity of the theory. So you cannot, if you have a process where you send, for instance, you make a collision of gauge bosons, of those non-abelian photons, those gluons, you cannot create ghosts on a physical process. You cannot create a pair of ghosts anti-ghosts. The amplitudes cancel. It's zero. So that's safe. The ghosts can appear in a virtual process, and they do have to be taken into account in virtual processes, but they never appear on the physical process. And that's a consequence of gauge invariance. Okay, so what I'm going to discuss now is very briefly the one-loop diagrams and the ultraviolet properties of the theory. So this is going to be very sketchy, and I probably won't be done by next week, but before tomorrow. But let me just show that. What's happening? First, first, there is something that is not present in QED, but since you have a three-vertex process, you might imagine that the expectation value of one gauge field is non-zero. Because, of course, classically, it's zero. But at one loop, you might have this diagram, which gives a radiative correction to the vacuum expectation value of the gauge potential. And that's a potentially dangerous term. OK. But since the gauge field interacts with the ghosts, you have also this diagram, where you have a virtual loop of ghosts. Okay. And the coupling of the ghost with the gauge field is quite similar to the coupling of the three particle coupling of the gauge field, because you see, it's proportional to G, there is some tensor, and there is a momentum. So they have the same form. And when you do the calculation, you find that this is turns out to be equal to this. Okay. And now you have to remember that the ghost field are fermions. They're anti-commute. So there is a minus one coming from the loop. Because you remember, because of the anti-commutation, each time that you have a loop of fermions, you have a minus sign that comes from the Fermi statistics. Because of Fermi statistics. So you can see it either coming from the Fermi statistics or just in the path integral formulation from the fact that the fermions anti-commutes, the C and C bar anti-commutes. Okay. And so this gives turns out to be zero. So this terms would have been a disaster for gauge invariance is zero. And you see that the ghosts do what they were expecting to do. They make the theory gauge invariant. OK, so now for the two loop, the two gauge field diagram, this is the tree level. And then you have the one loop diagrams. And the one loop diagram, there is this one. There is this one. But there is also a diagram with a virtual ghost loops. And if you have fermions or matter fields, you have the standard matter field term. But I'm not going to write it here. OK? And now, if you think about what's going on, there are problems that you do not have in QED. Because in QED, none of these diagrams exist. You have only the diagram where you have a virtual loop of electrons and positrons. So you create particle and antiparticles. So that's the famous effect of pair creation, annihilation, virtual pairs. It's not there because I've not treated. But if you like, you can add it. this is standard. Okay. So these terms, you may say, okay, they are there, and if there are some, this one is going to have a minus sign. But this one too, because it's a fermions. This one is going to have a minus sign. But there is dangerous warning. So this one is zero. This one, there is potential ultraviolet divergences. Okay. Because first, this diagram, if you have an internal momentum k that circulates, this is a diagram that we have studied in phi to the 4. This is the statpole diagram. So these diagrams is divergent, and it's quadratically divergent. If you put a cutoff, it's diverges as lambda squared, if you put a cutoff. This one too, because it seems to be the standard one-loop diagram of phi 4 that diverge like a log, but remember, the vertice contains some momenta. And so if the contribution, you may have a contribution of the momenta that flow there and the contribution of the momenta here that flow there. So this gives a 1 over k squared times 1 over k squared times k squared. So this one diverges also like lambda squared. Okay? And finally, what about this one? Well, this one also diverges like lambda squared, because you have a propagator of Gauss, which is 1 over k squared. This one is 1 over k squared. But remember, you have a momentum, contribution of the momentum outgoing here, and you have the contribution of the momentum outgoing here. So also, this one diverges. So there is a dangerous lambda squared divergence. And this would mean a mass renormalization for the gauge field. So you could say, okay, we are in phi 4, there is a mass renormalization at one loop, but we just renormalize the mass and we get a theory which makes sense. Why not renormalize the mass of the gauge field? Well, this is forbidden by gauge invariance. Remember, in order to have gauge invariance, the gauge field must be massless. Otherwise, there are 4 degrees of freedom. Okay, this is forbidden. Or at least this is very bad, let's say. If this occurs, this is very bad for gauge invariance. And this is a problem that stopped upon which the, well, in the 50s and the 60s, where people were starting to consider non-abelian gauge series, they said, no, but they cannot be renormalized because we have this problem. Gauge invariance is spoiled by quantum effect. Well, here again, the miracle. Here you have a lambda squared, here you have a lambda squared, and here you have the minus lambda squared, and thanks to the signs of the signs, so thanks to the, thanks the ghosts, lambda squared has a coefficient which is 0. And make the calculation. So the ghost, again, makes the job and makes the theory at least compatible with gauge invariant. Well, the same thing happens level, and you can see that if you look at the three-point function, AAA, you have, this is the classical term, the three-vertex interaction, and then you have well, I'm, as usual here, I'm drawing only the irreducible vertices. Okay. Irreducible. as we discussed in 5.4. You have this one. You have this one. Well, and some. Then you can make permutation of the vertices. And then you have the one where you have an internal loops of ghosts. And eventually the one with an internal loops of fermions. Okay. And this one again has a minus sign, so ghosts loop. Those two are gauge loops. Okay. And then I think you may still have a problem with this one because. Well, again, you have this one. And is this diagram, this 1 over k squared, 1 over k squared, here you have no k, but here you might have 1 k. Here you have 1 over k to the 6th, but you have 1 k, 1 k, 1 k. So potentially, they diverge like lambda. Well, by symmetry, I think by parity, this is not going to happen, but this one also appears like so. So you have potential divergences which are linear, proportional to lambda. And again, you do the calculation in the proper time, and you find that the coefficient is zero. Okay. Okay. And finally, for the 4 gluon vertex, it's going to be more complicated. It's written in the course, but somewhere, well, you have more diagrams, but you have a gluon, you have a gauge loops, and you have this. With a minus sign. Okay. And finally, you have to consider the propagators. So we consider the propagator for the gauge field, but you have to consider also the ghost propagator. This is a 4 gauge boson vertex. This was the 3 boson vertex. And the ghost propagator we have seen is classically the same than the scalar boson. And then since its coupling to the gauge bosons looks very much like the one of the fermions to QED, you have this. Okay. And finally, you have the gauge ghost vertex, which a classical order is this. And it contains at one loop order this one, which is very similar to the diagram you have in QED at one loop. Your fermions emit the virtual bosons and absorb the real one and then reabsorb the virtual one. But in addition, you have also this one. Because the gauge boson interacts with itself, so you can emit a gauge boson. It interacts with the real gauge bosons, and the resulting virtual bosons are reabsorbed. Okay. Okay, so I think that's it. And again, here, this is potentially ultraviolet divergent. So we have seen that the leading Danrus divergence, the lambda squared and lambda, disappear. Now we have to look at what happens for the subleading divergence. And okay, this diagram is zero, so it's not there, but this diagram is non-zero. And even if the lambda squared divergence disappears here, you compute and you find that they can still be a log lambda divergence, as we expect for phi to the four. So we still have log of the cutoff ultraviolet divergences. And basically both here, and both here. You do the calculation. So the work is not finished, because it means that basically all the terms in this action require some renormalization. Both the AA standard Maxwell coupling, both the three gauge boson interaction term, both the four gauge boson interaction term, both the ghost propagator, and both the gauge ghost propagator. So this means that we need, as in QED, a field renormalization for A and C bar. And we need a coupling renormalization for all the terms, for AAA, or rather DAAA, for AAAA, and for C bar DAC. And in fact, there are three of them, for C bar AC, and for C bar ADC, and for C bar DAC. Okay. And all those terms carry a lot of indices, Lorentz and group indices. But in the original theory, gauge invariance tells us that there is only one coupling. See? So the coupling which is there both for the three and four gauge field interaction is fixed by gauge symmetry. And the coupling between C and A is also fixed by gauge symmetry. So you cannot change one of the coupling here and do not change here. You spoil gauge symmetry. And so, and that's, I'm going to explain just the result tomorrow. We have only one coupling, gauge invariance. Invariance tells you that there is a lot of symmetry and only one coupling. if you want, or only one charge. So the charge of the ghosts, of the fermions, if any, and of the gauge field is fixed, and the interaction between the different fields is completely fixed by the gauge symmetry. You have no freedom of... Okay, so we have to ensure that that ultraviolet singularity do not spoil this. Namely, that the structure of the ultraviolet divergence is such that only one counter term in the coupling constant and the change in the normalization of the field, which is some arbitrariness, is enough to remove all the divergence. If this was not true, this would be mean that there would be what is called gauge anomalies. Okay. And for pure non-abelian Young-Mead theory, we don't expect any anomaly. There are some gauge theories with fermions, chiral fermions, where you might have gauge anomalies. So not expected for pure gauge. Okay. So that's what I'm going to discuss very briefly, because the calculation is a famous but long one. I'm going to discuss the properties of the renormalized theory tomorrow. Okay. But I hope you see what is a potential problem, and which was the problem that has blocked people for several years in the 60s.